Well, tonight we have a very special guest, Glenn Clancy, speaking to us from Japan. Glenn Clancy has made quite a name for himself in the 9/11 truth movement with an extraordinary film that he made single-handedly in 2007. Glenn is a graduate of Monash University, Commerce and Arts, and he's got a lot of skills and a lot of ability to put together a story, and he's done that in an extremely original way for an extremely important topic, which is the Bali bombings in Indonesia, which occurred in 2002, and also a very good breakdown of some of the political undercurrents of political interference that occurred during the East Timorese independence election and campaign for independence. So it's great to have you here on the show, Glenn. Welcome to Truth News Radio.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for that introduction.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I mean, you really have made quite a reputation for yourself. I've noticed your names come up quite a few times around the place. I just would love to know about how you came to make the film, what you know, anything interesting you can tell us about the process of making the film and what you've learned.
Well, I'd have to say it all started when I was watching some films through the internet in Japan, and I came across a little film called Loose Change, and this really, well, changed my life, because I started researching it. I couldn't believe that it was true, and I began researching it until I finally proved to myself that they were correct, and I wanted to learn more, and I'd always been interested in politics, but since the Iraq war began, I gave up, and I thought, there's nothing I can do. Obviously, the majority of Australians didn't want to go to war, and yet we have a government that takes us into war. So what power have the people got? So I had given up until I saw this movie, and it really opened my eyes. And I knew that just a couple of guys were able to make this movie. So I set about researching primarily about Australian foreign policy. And obviously the Bali bombings came up as a major event. And
I think that the like you mentioned of how that the Iraq war sort of crushed everyone's like ability to think almost. And I just really can relate to that. You know, I'm just like, I think I went through that, and a lot of people I know went through a similar process. Yeah. And you know, the Bali bombing occurred really, well, it was before the Iraq war.
Right. Yeah.
And it was within a year of 9/11, and very little was said about it other than what we heard through the television, through the radio. There was just this onslaught of news about Iraq and Al-Qaeda and Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden. And, yeah, it was just an absolute media, you know, blitzkrieg of propaganda at that time, I think, yeah.
Well, that was one of the things with the Bali bombings. There was, you know, they named off 10 different masterminds within 3 months.
Yeah.
So from the onset, people were confused. They didn't know what was going on. And a lot of people just gave up and didn't, you know, I can't understand what's happening, so why bother listening anymore, became the attitude. And I think that was part of their plan, in a way. The cover-up that was underway, they kept giving us all this misinformation, which really confused the people.
The mere misinformation, disinformation, spin, propaganda. I mean, you know, a lot of different words to basically basically mean lying. And, you know, they lied. And it's one of these things that we have to deal with, you know, as we start to realize what's going on is the degree of just blatant lying. And you mean your investigation so began with an interest in the Bali bombings, but in the film you actually go right back to 1999, and you take a really good long look at the whole East Timorese business, which I thought was really valid too and really important.
Well, I researched Australia's foreign policy, so I researched East Timor as well, and I'd also done a lot of research on the lead up to the Iraq War, and I actually was going to put that in as well. But having contacted Robert Finnegan and him confirming a lot of the information about the Bali bombings, I had to remove the content of the Iraq War because there was just too much. But in terms of East Timor, I couldn't leave that out because the lies were just so blatant from John Howard and Alexander Downer. I couldn't leave it out. It was just disgusting, and I really wanted to get that information out to people. And a lot of it came out already, but it had never been put all together. And a lot of the lies only came out 3 years after the event. So everyone forgets about it. And it was a very confusing... See, the main issue with the East Timor massacres was what the Australian government knew and when they knew it. So during the time, they just denied it the whole time.
Yeah.
And people were like, well, how do we know if they're lying or not? We don't. And then it came out a couple of years later, yes, they lied about this, they lied about this, they lied about this. But, you know, it was 3 years later, people moved on and didn't really understand the full extent of their lies and what the lies meant for the East Timorese people.
It seems that to me that the lies were really destructive, wanted that they actually wanted a bloodbath in East Timor, which is really horrific. I mean, you can write it down to sort of political shenanigans, but the effect was the murder of a lot of people. And
I think the main reason was there is a really strong, in fact, after I'd completed the movie, I did a little bit more research, and it seems to me that there is a very strong Indonesian lobby within the Australian government, which stemmed from the Suharto regime, and it hasn't gone away. It's still there. So when the Indonesian government wanted to keep occupation of East Timor, the Australian government felt that they had to let them do that. And in order to do that, they had to lie. So, and that's why they did lie, I believe.
In order to sort of maintain that relationship that they had with the corrupt government of the time.
Yes, because if they hadn't have lied, they would have been exposing the Indonesian government to their criminal activities.
Right, right. Are you saying the criminal activities of the Indonesian government or the criminal activities of the Australians?
The Indonesian.
Right, I see, yeah.
But primarily the military, obviously.
And the military who are arming the militias and...
Exactly.
It seemed that there was a game there of actually on both sides, the Australians wanted there to be some reason why they had to bring the troops in. That's kind of the impression I wanted. So if it had been all peaceful and everyone was getting along okay, well, there wouldn't really have been a need for an Australian intervention, would there? It wouldn't have been necessary for that to have occurred. And I don't know, they're still very much in control of East Timor, what I noticed years later. It's still, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that because the American government actually tried to send peacekeepers and argued against the Australian government that they wanted to send in Marines and peacekeepers, but the Australian government argued against it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they were on side with the Indonesian government, yes.
So the Americans were going to send peacekeepers?
Yes, they wanted to.
Right,
because, you know, they wanted to spread their influence around the world. They saw this as a good opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Australian government was so so bound to the Indonesian government that they didn't want to expose them.
You know, interesting thing I wanted to point out, and maybe, you know, we'll discuss this more as we get into discussing the Bali bombings, but in your account of the Bali bombings, there is a discussion of the fact that there were, I think, five peacekeepers who were stationed in East Timor who were evacuated out of the hospital. They were dead. I mean, they were bodies. Okay. But they were evacuated without any due process.
Yep.
Is there a connection here? Is there something
that's there's definitely a connection, because, you know, how else would have these people known that these UN peacekeepers were there and flown them out so quickly?
Right.
So this is within hours of the blast. Witnesses saw in the hospital, and because it was pandemonium, there was dead bodies everywhere, people burning and dying, and it was pandemonium. And these people, I don't know if they're in uniform or not, but they came, I can't remember, but they came into the hospital and took these five bodies, and they got onto a flight and were taken. And it's...
And it kind of suggests that those individuals were not just your plain, ordinary peacekeepers, but, I mean, it's just speculation. But, I mean, it sort of certainly indicates there's something more going on that we obviously don't know about.
Yes, yes. But, I mean, more than that, and that's the only information we know, and then it becomes speculation, you're right.
Yeah.
But more importantly, the thing that isn't speculation is that one of Robert Finnegan's who was one of the senior editors at the Jakarta Post, one of his investigation team went to the international airport in Bali to check the flight records, and there had been a lot of flights the day before the bombing and the day of the bombing and the day after the bombing that were changed and been whited out and then changed. Oh, both. They were both deleted and changed.
Right.
And then this man proceeded to go down to the ground logs, and the flights were all there. And the ones that they had deleted in the tower logs were still in the ground logs that they hadn't deleted. And this flight was actually registered as an Israeli Israeli aeroplane, which went to Singapore after, and this was carrying the five bodies, and that went to Singapore, and then they lost track of it after that.
Okay.
But I didn't put that in the movie.
Yeah,
didn't put that in the movie because it gets sticky, because there's not enough information about it. I mean, all we know is that some flights were deleted, and that's the question: why were these flights deleted? And the days before that were completely clean, and it was only the days around the bombing that had been changed and deleted.
Oh, g'day, Glenn. It's Josh here.
How are you, mate?
Good, good. One part of the film that really blew my mind was the episode of Mythbusters that you put in there. It was just a little cut when they blew apart a massive cement mixer. And I remember seeing that episode. It was absolutely amazing because they basically just blew this thing to smithereens. They had massive bomb experts. They had to move kilometers away from this scene. And the thing didn't even leave a crater. I mean, this thing, it exploded so harshly that there was only tiny bits of debris of this full-on cement mixer, which wasn't just a cement mixer, but the barrel of the cement mixer at the back was half filled with solidified concrete. And the myth was to try and can you use dynamite to, you know, get rid of this thing, well, as you know, Glenn.
Can we just before we get right into that, because like I really want to get into that if we've got time.
Sure.
But I was just getting Glenn to kind of lead us into this, because I mean, we're talking here about some issues that he covered in the film, which precede the Bali bombings.
Right.
We talked about the East Timorese liberation campaign of independence,
sure. Yep.
the elections, and the violence that occurred there. And you know, we were just talking about the connection with the peacekeepers who were evacuated from the hospital. But now, the whole question of the bombing, which occurred at that crucial time, which was in the lead up to the Iraq War, it was one of the most important single events that kind of propelled Australia to be part of the war, but it also had an international effect. I mean, it was such a huge bombing. It was really, I mean,
a lot of Britons were killed, and I remember it was always this is Australia's 9/11. On the mainstream media it was parroted constantly. Australia's 9/11. We've had our 9/11 now.
Yeah, yeah.
We've had our 9/11 now, and this was the psychological attack on us again. Now, whether that was an inside job or not, it was used as a massive psychological attack on us to then propel an agenda which was already written. But yeah, as Glenn points out in his fantastic film, it absolutely points to some really dodgy activity that needs to be investigated.
Now,
I think that it had two reasons that they wanted to have a massive terrorist attack in Indonesia, and that was, yes, to get the Australians on side with the Iraq War, which didn't work, but the Australian government went anyway, and to get the perception out that there were terrorists in Southeast Asia, which to that stage was yet to be established. And after the Bali bombings, there was this whole Jamaat Islamiya, and there was a Southeast Asia Al-Qaeda. And so there were two main reasons, I think, for this operation.
And when this film came out, sorry to divert a little bit, what sort of reaction did you send out to some of the family members, and did you get any reaction to them?
I haven't yet, because I wanted to give them a chance to receive it passively. I didn't want to put this information on them so they would feel pressured.
Mm.
So I'm hoping that they are able to see this just by chance.
Yeah, I can understand your caution there, and it's well advised. I mean, it's a very tricky one to approach.
Well, it's a deep rabbit hole, you know. People need to slowly, I guess, ease into the fact that their governments aren't the beautiful mother that it's touting to be.
But if we can just get back into the flow of this of the basically the stuff you cover in the film, because I'm really interested in how you actually. One question I wanted to ask you is how you got all of that footage, because it's really great footage in East Timor, and you've where did you find all that stuff?
I found that on YouTube.
Really, really, it was all available on YouTube, was it? Fantastic.
Yeah.
And the power of the internet.
I mean, I've never sold it, so
right.
That's what I'm going on.
Yeah.
And how long did it take you to make from cradle to grave? When?
Well, I researched for about 7 months.
Right.
Solid, and then it probably took me about 3 months to make the movie.
Once you basically compiled everything. Yeah, so you compiled all your resources.
And then I wrote the script, and I wrote exactly what I wanted to make.
Right.
And then it took me about 3 months to make it in the program.
What sort of video editing did you use, if you don't mind my asking?
I used, it's called Sony Vegas.
Yeah, I use that. Yeah, yeah, it's quite good, isn't it?
So, and this was my first time ever using this program, so.
Sure.
Hopefully it came out okay.
It does. It has a good flow. You know, when the first time I watched it, I thought, oh, it was a bit odd that you had all that material on East Timor. But when I actually sat through and watched it, I was really glad that I did. And I think that there's a pattern of deception, and this is what we've got to realize, and we've got to, you know, I don't know. None of us really know what the solution to this is. Look, all we know is that we've got to talk about it. We've got to get it out there. We've got to get people to understand.
I think the main thing with Australians is they really, truly, they haven't lived through tyranny. Apart from the Aboriginal people who absolutely have, but the general white Aussie has really lived a gluttonous lifestyle of total, you know, everything at their fingertips. And that's not to say, this is even the hardworking Aussies. There's always food on the table. There's been a safety net of the dole. And you know, some people have had it hard. Don't you mean, I'm not painting the whole of Australia with an easy brush. But hardcore tyranny hasn't really arisen yet. So this whole notion that governments might do something bad to gain an agenda or gain further an agenda, it really doesn't even come into the psyche of the general middle class Aussie. And to sort of, I think films like this, to sort of wake up and see and categorize and chronicle the deceptions that were paved through the East Timor and to the Bali bombings. I mean, just to go back to that point about the Mythbusters exploding thing, I mean, what I found fascinating about that is it really outlaid, this was such a massive explosion, and it left no crater in the ground in the Mythbusters thing. Now, the crater in the Bali bombing and the second bomb that went off was, it was quite massive.
Exactly. And do you know that that was dynamite that they used in Mythbusters? Because I never found out exactly what it was.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it was. It was based TNT, I'm pretty sure.
So it does prove that it's going to take a larger explosion than that which was seen in the Mythbusters episode than the one they're saying, because they claim that it was about a ton of potassium chlorate. Now, TNT is about, or dynamite with TNT is about 5 times more powerful than potassium chlorate. Now, if this truck has been loaded with TNT, you know, and you've got a van loaded with potassium chlorate, well, it's no comparison. And so right there, you've got a massive hole in the story.
And a massive hole in the ground too.
And a massive hole.
I mean, that was what really stood out with this supposed car bomb, is the, you know, giant crater.
And not only that, I mean, windows were smashed in a massive circumference of the actual center point, blast point.
Well, I mean, I've seen aerial photographs, and it looks like ground zero of Hiroshima. I mean, it's just flattened. Everything's flattened.
The most important piece of evidence is now at the bottom of the ocean, where they, which they dumped into the ocean within about a week of the investigation starting, and that is the rebar which was stripped of its concrete. Now, that was 50 feet from the crater, which is obviously the point of the blast, and according to Marine Corps figures, it takes 1 million, at least 1 million pounds per square inch of overpressure to strip the concrete.
Now, were you able to see at all any examples of this rebar that had the concrete stripped from?
I have. And I've recently seen better photos than I put into the movie. And
great.
In the movie, it is a little bit difficult to see because they were the only photos I had at the time. But I have since seen the actual concrete rod standing up, and then you can see the rebar coming out of that concrete, and it's been completely stripped. So it's clear as day that that concrete has actually been stripped.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have like you don't have to be like an expert to understand that stripping concrete from rebar must take an incredible amount of energy. I mean, it's just it's really quite incredible.
Well it's elementary. It's elementary.
The math's there,
because
right?
It's science. It takes at least 1 million. Now, potassium chlorate at that distance has a maximum overpressure force of about 2 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
So, you know,
That's a smoking gun right there.
Yeah. It's case closed. It's impossible that it was potassium chlorate. And their final conclusion was that it was potassium chlorate.
Glenn, was there ever any radioactivity measurements taken at the blast point? Or some sort of Geiger counter out there to sort of check?
I think there was, but no independent. But this is the interesting point. See, the most likely explosive device that was used was a micronuclear device because of the stripped concrete and because the injuries and the way people died. I mean, some of the people completely vanished. Their bones... you know, if you've got stripped concrete, you're going to have stripped human beings.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were vanished. So.
Yeah. So, how popular are these? I mean, how prevalent are these type of explosive device if it was indeed something like a mini nuke?
Well, I think this is probably one of the first times it's been used.
Yeah.
And when you said the Geiger device, that doesn't measure. I think that only measures something like beta or alpha rays.
Right.
And that only measures the uranium type nuclear devices.
Uh-huh.
But if you have a plutonium nuclear device, it's not going to pick up the nuclear remnants.
That sort of footprint, right.
Exactly. So you need a specific device to measure the radiation.
Mm.
You know,
I mean,
this kind of technology was around 20 years ago that they had micronuclear devices. So you can imagine what they have today.
Well, exactly. I mean, the military complex, that's all they do. They just research explosive devices, you know, spend billions of dollars on this stuff. Mm. So it's not impossible.
Important point is that people think that, micronuclear device, well, then where's all the radiation? Why aren't people dying later? Well, with the plutonium nuclear device, people in direct contact will die straight away and other people will not suffer long-term diseases. It will only be the people in immediate contact who will have died that will be affected by the blast.
And there were examples of people who were vaporized. I've heard some, you know, extreme cases of bodies just completely being just fried.
Well, there were the only. Well, how can you prove that they were vaporized?
Yeah, I know. So not totally vaporized, but charred beyond any, you know, possible recognition.
Well, that's another very important point, that the official death toll was 202. Now, I just read an article a couple of weeks ago that a lot of the people in the hospital at the time, they were saying 187 people had died, and they were all saying that count is ridiculous. It's more like 300. Mm. It's more like 400 people, because there were still about over 100 bags of human remains that weren't even accounted for.
Well, it's funny that they didn't take advantage of that and just overdo it.
Mm. Well, then it would have made it more difficult to cover up the fact that it was a potassium chlorate explosive.
Yeah. And Glenn, what's What are you going to do after now? Is there a chance of a second edition from some of this new information you've come out, or are you on other projects now? Or,
well, I'm thinking about it. I'm toying with the idea. If I get enough information, I probably will.
Yeah.
But I'm still yet to decide.
Well, it's a very, very amazing documentary. It's a very important documentary because it's the only one that actually challenged anything.
Yeah.
From all the, you know, million-dollar mainstream media investigative journalists out there, you know, here's a kid that's produced something so important and so amazing, and I really congratulate you. You know, well,
thanks very much.
It was fantastic.
The story wouldn't even been. I mean, the main reason why I did it was because of Robert Finnegan, who was the senior editor at the Jakarta Post at the time, and he was, if you've seen the movie, he was fired from his job because he was exposed too much. Because actually, in his special report that he printed a couple of months after the attacks, he outlined the concrete that was stripped, and he put in the actual Marine Corps figures in his article shortly after he was sacked and had his journalist visa cancelled. So, you know, his team, you're right, was the only team, were the only people that were brave enough to not simply blindly accept the official story.
Now, I think yeah, it's excellent. And you know, I think the question of what type of bomb it was, is not one we have to answer. And this is a common problem with these things where we're looking into unknowns. We know that it was a very powerful bomb. We know it must have been a high tech bomb. The question of whether it was a nuke or whether it was just some other high tech explosive, well, really, it doesn't matter, because and quite often these discussions get hung up on a single point like that, and then you get the media hit pieces that go, oh, such and such person has a conspiracy theory, you know, oh, they believe nukes were used, oh, how crazy is that? So and this is a very, very common pattern that I've seen over and over again. And like what I'd just like to emphasize, you know, for our audience is that we don't, when we're dealing with things that we really don't have all the facts, we cannot offer the answer, and it would be ridiculous to assume we could. But I mean, in your film, you quite make a plausible scenario that it may well be this, the points that you make, I think that have the strongest, that make the strongest convincing argument is when you just show that the physical process of the blast cannot have come from what they said it came from, which means they were lying. And this thing about catching people in lies is very important. Like we got to realize that when you're trying to get to the truth of something, you may never get the real truth. You may be able to catch people in lies. And, you know, this brings me to the next topic that I want you to actually get into a little bit with us. We'll just after the break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm Herewood Fenton, and Josh Jackson is here tonight, and we are talking to Glenn Clancy, the creator, producer, director, and you know, completely original
thinker
behind Fool Me Twice, an internet movie covering Indonesian events such as the East Timorese elections and independence campaign and the Bali bombings, and evidence of deception, Australian government complicity, Indonesian government complicity, and complicity from various parts of the international intelligence community. And it's that last part that I want to get into discussing with Glenn in this part of the interview. Glenn, in the film, you document that there were a number of relationships that took place between several of the Bali bombers and several intelligence operatives, and you point out a few things that I found really, really interesting. And one of them was that one of these people was actually, I think, arrested and then released and ended up in Afghanistan and then was locked up in the American prison there in Bagram Air Force Base, and then and then somehow escaped again. I don't know if there's anything you can.
Well, that was Omar al-Farouk.
Yeah.
And he was actually rendered over to the United States by the Indonesian government about in June of 2002. So that was 4 months before the bombings.
Okay.
And he, in fact, was cited in American intelligence reports and Australian intelligence reports that there was going to be an event in Indonesia, a terrorist attack. And obviously that that occurred. And then after the bombings, he was called into U.S. court. And immediately he was called into court, the Bush administration claimed that he had escaped the high security prison in Afghanistan that he was staying at.
As you do.
Can't be that hard.
Oh, you're just a high security, you know.
Jump over the fence, eh?
Well, you know, it's pretty much impossible. So not only do you have a high-level supposed al-Qaeda operative escaping jail, but he was the prime source of information that was going to occur. And, in fact, that information was used to threaten the Indonesian government to hand over Abu Bakar Bashir before the bombing.
Oh, before the bombing?
Before the bombings. See, Abu Bakar Bashir was the CIA threatened President Megawati to hand over Bashir before the bombings, but President Megawati refused because he was too well known. This was speculated about in the media, but the American government denied that they had tried to secretly hand him over. But the American translator that was in that meeting decided to speak out and actually told everyone that, yeah, that actually did take place, that they had tried to secretly hand him over. And interestingly enough, this man becomes the main person of the bombings, and he's the mastermind, and he's the one that they try to blame.
So you suspect that he may well be an intelligence operative.
Abu Bakar Bashir?
I know the other chap that was...
Omar al-Farouk? Yeah.
Yeah. And now are there others that you can identify as being intelligence operatives who were connected to the Bali bombers? Because I think there are a few other things in the film.
Well, the former, just before I get on to other people, the former Indonesian intelligence chief, A.C. Manilang, said 2 months before the bombings that Omar al-Farouk was, in fact, CIA agent. And he had been sent to recruit people for a terrorist network.
Well, that's pretty damning, isn't it?
There's been high-level people that have said that Omar al-Farouk was a CIA agent, and then he goes ahead and escapes jail.
See, with such amazing information, why hasn't some of these journalists actually exposed this?
Yeah.
Why hasn't
it been on the ABC?
Yeah, why haven't you seen it?
On SBS? It just proves right there.
It really infuriates me.
Other people, well, there was another person who had been in contact with Omar al-Farouk, but I don't think was directly involved in the Bali bombings. His name was Fatah Roman al-Ghozi, and he was captured in the Philippines, I think, and then he escaped jail too. So I think it's safe to say whenever a high-level al-Qaeda operative escapes jail, you can be sure that there's more to the story.
So did he escape jail at the same time? Was it the same?
It was a different time. Different time, different place.
Oh, God. It's just unbelievable, isn't it? It just goes on and on. It truly is. I mean, when the Australian government said that it's the next 9/11, they were right. I mean, there's just so much damning evidence that people really to not expose this further is a crime in itself.
And the other possibly most important person was Fawzi Hasbi, who actually facilitated a so-called Jama'a Islamiyah meeting in January of 2000, and he was later exposed as an Indonesian intelligence agent by SBS Australia. SBS Australia's Dateline, and shortly after he was exposed, he was murdered.
You are joking.
And his son, who gave the interview to SBS Dateline, died in a plane crash soon after as well.
I remember that. Yeah.
There's a lot more to this man, Fawzi Hasbi, because he was facilitating meetings around 2000, and this is the same time that Abu Bakr Bashir decided to go public with his Islamic movement, and he created the Mujahideen Council of Indonesia. And the International Crisis Group actually reported that Abu Bakr Bashir had a falling out with a lot of the members in his group. And this is when the bombing campaigns began. And in the year of 2000, there was the Christmas Eve bombings, which a lot of mysterious things about that event as well. And Fawzi Hasbi was actually the center of that plot of the Christmas bombings.
You're kidding.
And he had actually called the man that was sent to jail for building the bombs. He had actually called that man several times in the lead up to the bombings. So he was a central part of the 2000 Christmas Eve bombings, and he was later exposed as an
Indonesian. The Christmas Eve bombings, which took place where exactly?
All across Indonesia. It was a
all across bombing. Indonesia.
There were a few cities that were bombed, churches.
You know, it's interesting. Here in Australia, they just recently been going over these some sort of Islamic terrorist, so-called terrorist group here in Australia, and they got arrested, and it turns out that, you know, they're just casually reporting on the news that, well, there was an insider from the police, from ASIO, had got in there, and then as the story goes on, you realize that this ASIO guy was teaching them how to make the bombs, that these guys didn't actually know how to make any of the bombs. It was this, Australian government agent basically setting them up, taking them into the woods and showing them, and then this crazy guy who was obviously nuts saying, "Oh, could you make a bigger one for us?" And then they basically sting them and arrest them.
Mm. Well, Abu Bakr Bashir was actually being set up before in the 70s. He was actually set up by the Suharto military intelligence, and he was sent to jail for almost 3 years for creating a so-called Jama'a, which is a community, to fight against the communists. But he was actually provoked into that by military intelligence. So he's actually been set up before 30 years ago.
God, and it sounds very much like the Al-Qaeda of Afghanistan.
It sounds very much like the CIA. I mean, I just want to tie this in to the practices that the CIA have been using all over the world. And I know the CIA were very closely involved with the Suharto government. They basically allowed Suharto to come to power. They wanted to get Sukarno out of the way. Sukarno was the nationalist leader who was the kind of really the popular leader of the people after the Dutch were kicked out of Indonesia. And he was not a perfect person. Obviously, he had his faults, but he wasn't such a tyrant as Suharto, and he had a lot of relationships with the Russians as well as the Americans. He was playing both sides, and they didn't want him there. And basically, there was a massive coup d'etat that occurred in Indonesia in the mid 1960s under the careful guidance of the CIA. And I mean, this whole decade of the 60s was a period where interventions in other countries, as well as within the United States, with the assassination of Kennedy, which again was another government run operation, and had all the hallmarks of the same types of things that you're talking about, Glenn. It's just interesting because I was recently watched Oliver Stone's JFK, and just like the things that we're talking about here, where you have like government operatives getting involved with terrorist groups, sort of training them, preparing patsies. All this occurred in relation to the Kennedy assassination, and it's quite clear that Oswald was an operative who was working under military intelligence. He was actually, playing both sides, as they often do. Once for a while he was communist, then he was anti-communist. There were all these total anomalies, and the whole while, the planning of this event, which was the assassination of Kennedy, was being prepared. He was set up to be the patsy, as he himself said, and this was all being run from within a cell of the FBI. I mean, the whole operation. And so, what's staggering?
Well, it's the modus operandi of almost all intelligence agencies in the world that have any influence.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which is in the movie.
Yes.
They were all on the payroll of the CIA. So, and the bomb was actually built by the FBI. So,
yeah.
It's always intelligence agencies involved.
And grooming of people that they can use in variety of roles. I mean, it's just incredible. And the reach of these organizations that they're able to do this is chilling. The fact that they're able to manipulate people to find their weaknesses, to exploit their anger and their hatred about various things, to set up patsies, to one thing that's occurred to me about this, and, I've done a fair amount of research on a lot of different levels, is that when you have a very deliberate attempt to subvert justice by creating false flag operations, it is virtually impossible for a normal justice system to operate. Because by that I mean when a well-organized group can basically set up a fake event and then have an individual who is set up to be the fall guy for the event by creating false chain of evidence.
That's great.
The average person cannot deal with it. It is too mind-boggling for the average person to grasp that this has actually been done deliberately, and they win every time with this. It's a technique that they've used over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, it's like giving some kid who's or some family is absolutely dead poor, can't afford to feed themselves, some dope, and giving them out in the street, and then arresting them for it. You know, you're basically setting these people up, people that they're doing something. So,
but my point, Josh, was with the general public, though. And because like what I'm pointing out is that the general public is incapable of grasping when they've been hoodwinked.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, example is Port Arthur. Now, I've done a fair amount of research into Port Arthur, and what I know is that the supposed reports of Martin Bryant having been seen early in the day having an argument at a toll booth. Now, this is a pattern I've seen over and over again. Muhammad Atta was reported having an argument in an airport toll booth. Martin Bryant had a loud argument which grabbed everyone's attention, right? This is a deliberate tactic. The person who did that was not Martin Bryant, okay? The person who did that, in my assessment, was the person that they assigned to do that to make a witness, to create a witness event, so that you would say, someone would say, oh, I saw a guy, he had an argument with me, he had long blonde hair. That's the Martin Bryant. With Muhammad Atta, it was, again, he had several arguments which drew attention to himself, and then later on that became part of the narrative. And the same thing happens in the Kennedy assassination with Lee Harvey Oswald. You have Lee Harvey Oswald going around shooting ranges, and it wasn't really Lee Harvey Oswald, because Lee Harvey Oswald was actually in Mexico at the time, but it was a guy who matched the description of Lee Harvey Oswald, same build, same height, same hair, who went to a shooting range and said in a loud voice, "Oh, I'm practicing to shoot the president." I mean, you know, this is, it's ridiculous, but it works because it sets up in people's mind an expectation of, well, this can't be coincidence. You know, there can't be so many coincidences. This must be evidence. And that's all they need. In many cases, it never goes to court. With all of these false flag operations like Muhammad Atta, well, he never had to go to court. You know, he was removed from the equation. Martin Bryant, well, he was, you know, mentally, you know, basically mentally retarded anyway. So he wouldn't have been able to defend himself. But they set up these events. They use false evidence. And it's all about a public relations game of convincing the general public their little game, you know.
To stay in fear. Yeah. Yeah. So I think what would you, Glenn, say to the general public to you know, what was your purpose for making this film? I guess to wake people up to the indiscretions and the things that weren't reported on?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Bali bombings, no one knows what actually happened. I mean, you ask the average person on the street in Australia, they'll say, yeah, Amrozi did it. Mm. And that's it. That's all they'll know. So...
yeah, with Amrozi, that's one thing. Why doesn't he say, hey, look, you know, is he... has his family been given some money, or I mean, how can someone
high possibility, because he is a primary school graduate and he's obviously illiterate and he's a mechanic. So, you know, he's not a very intelligent person, and it's highly possible that he has been given bribes.
Yeah.
And given all the other evidence that the investigators have blatantly lied, that is a very probable answer.
Yeah, because that's one thing I haven't ever, you know, because he must have been sitting there in court and they must have, you know, skipped over a lot of this information in court, even lightly, about the size of the bomb and stuff. I mean... yeah, so obviously there's something going on there, yeah.
Well, he might have been tortured. Well, he claims that he was tortured, all three of them.
Yeah.
And they were tortured to saying that Bashir was their leader and that Bashir was part of a group called Jamaat Islamiya. And so they reported that they were tortured. So in the beginning, during the court cases, that was probably the reason why they gave the so-called correct answers. But in terms of today, why they don't speak, it could be bribes, could be, we don't really know. But they have said at different times that Amrozi did say that the bomb that he prepared could not have caused that damage and it must have been the CIA. So they have on occasions said that it was intelligence agencies.
Yeah, that's right.
Of the blast.
Huh. This chap, the head of the police, what's his name, who went and saw Bush and Cheney and was gloating about it, the head of the intelligence we were talking about earlier.
Which man?
I think it was either the head of the Indonesian anti-terror police or...
General Daybakir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just wanted to explain to the audience this culture where the anti-terror squads really need terrorism to survive, because the amount of funding they got after that bomb was phenomenal.
Well, there's a section in the film, Glenn, where this police chief is taken, well, he's describing how well he was treated and he had a wonderful time and they took him to this marvelous place. Do you remember the bit we're talking about?
Yeah,
I know exactly the bit you're talking about, yes. And he was bloating about how he had met Dick Cheney and had been to the White House and, yes, and they were following him around like a puppy dog.
You've really chosen some amazing footage there, and because that scene just stood out. Because I actually remember seeing that on mainstream media when it happened. I remember thinking, "What a dodgy guy," you know. And this is the culture of terrorism. I mean, if you look at all the courses in anti-terrorism now, universities and intelligence courses, it's this whole culture we're building around an industry of fear, an industry of terrorism that basically entrenches the need for terrorism in the future, because all these people need a job. And that's really an important part of the film that you put in there, is that that it's really showing these people for what they are, happy, almost happy, to have, you know. I mean, he had his chest puffed out. I met Dick Cheney. I mean, it was really absolutely disgusting to see.
Well, it's a self-perpetuating myth. I mean, there is no Al-Qaeda network, and it's a myth. And these people, they're chasing ghosts,
But it suits their ego and obviously probably financially too
Absolutely, yeah.
Look, there's one more thing I wanted to get into tonight a little bit, and I don't know if you're able to really elaborate on this more. But famous quote from the former Indonesian president Abdul Rahman Wahid, Gus Dur, he's sometimes known as the blind one, who was president briefly for, I think, about a year or two. Now, he was interviewed on SBS Dateline, I think, in about 2003. And he said blatantly, he just said it straight out, he said, yes, well, the Bali bombers, Amrozi and those people, they were responsible for the little bomb, but the Indonesian government, the Indonesian military was responsible for the large bomb. And I've never heard any follow-up on that. I've never heard anything more on it.
Well, they claim that he's the conscience of the nation.
Yep.
So he has high respect, probably more respect than any other president that's ever been in Indonesia. And yeah, he said that the so-called Bali bombings were set up and that the main explosive was possibly put there by the military. He said he didn't know who. He said possibly by the military. So you have the most respected person in Indonesia saying that these guys were set up.
Amazing.
And zero, you know, I mean, the Australian Federal Police, with all their amazing forensic abilities, leading the investigation, managed to uncover
smiling assassin.
You know, the confessions of the bombers, basically. I mean, why would they even need police work? I mean, they always either managed to get identification, like they got from the London bombers, where they got all their identification miraculously preserved, even though their bodies were blown to bits, their identification was in perfect nick.
Hardcore laminating, mate.
Yeah, or they just get confessions. I mean, it's so easy doing police work these days, isn't it? I mean,
well, they actually had 3D simulators of the buildings and the position that the explosive went off.
Wow!
And then they ran all the witnesses through that 3D image, describing what happened.
Wow!
And they can't even get the explosive right.
Yeah.
So they did a 3D model of the explosion. My goodness.
Yeah.
That must have cost a bit of public money.
Yeah, interestingly, I read recently that they had people at the international airport searching people's bags and taking footage off people as they boarded the plane to leave back to Australia.
Another standard CIA intel black op, you know, procedure. You know, just and the other thing I heard from, I listened to that interview with Robert Finnegan, and he was saying that within 24 hours of the attacks, Bali Kuta Beach was swarming with international intelligence agents. Again, another signature of a black op. I mean, do you know anything more about that? Is that, I can't remember whether that's covered in your film or not, but
it's not, no. Yeah. But yeah, he said there were CIA, Mossad, and even French intelligence and other intelligence agencies, which he could not identify, but he suspected that they were there by the time he got there. And he was there within hours. I guess that he was probably there within 12 hours. And all these intelligence operatives were already at the scene.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff, Glenn. Well, I think we should wrap it up.
Okay.
Glenn, thank you very, very much for coming on. We'll have to have you on again sometime.
Not a problem.
An amazing film. Where can people see this?
If you type Fool Me Twice into Google Video, it should come up number one.
Fool Me Twice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Glenn, I'd like to have you on again soon and you know, regularly to keep up to date with what your next plans are. I know you're planning to return to Australia and you know, just best of luck with whatever your next project is, but we'd like to stay informed, and we'd like to just keep everyone else informed as well.
No problems at all. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Glenn. Cheers, mate.
Okay.
There well, goes that's
Glenn
a wrap.
Clancy. Amazing guy. Amazing filmmaker.
And that is the end of the show, and I seem to have lost my partner, Josh. Josh, farewell. Good night, Australia. Good night, world. See you next week.